Silence.
Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Pride Radio.
Nerd alert.
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 39 of Nerd Pride Radio. 39, the Japanese Garo Owasi representation for thank you. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's probably like seven other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place where I go every week, or two or three, to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my noggin anymore. My co-host this week is Professor Lazarus Severus Metatron. Welcome. Okay. And I mentioned 39, Garo Owasi representation for thank you. I have no idea if Garo Owasi is the correct way to pronounce that. Don't care. But it's a cool form of Japanese wordplay. Right, apparently, in Japanese, you can pronounce numbers, the digits 0 to 9. You can pronounce them in up to three or four different ways for each digit. And so the wordplay game that they do is when you have a number, you try to pick the pronunciations that will make actual words or sentences. So, for example, 39, 39, those two digits can be pronounced in such a way that it makes thank you in Japanese. Cool. And so, when they're texting, quite often, people who know that will use 39 as an abbreviation for thank you when they're texting. So other ones, for example, 893 can be pronounced Yakuza, Japanese Mafia. Cool. Or if you're in an American movie about Japan, you pronounce it Yakuza. 888 can be used for laughter instead of LOL or something like that, because 888 can be pronounced ha ha ha. All right. And then, this was my favorite one, if you want to remember the first nine digits of pi, 3.14159265, in Japanese, pick the correct pronunciations for it, and you get the mnemonic device. An obstetrician goes to a foreign country, except, you know, obviously in Japanese. The sentence doesn't have anything to do with pi, but if you can remember obstetricians going to foreign countries, you can remember the first nine digits of pi. They're cool. All right, and I, of course, know this because, well, not because I lived in Japan for a few months, even though I did, but because I just stumbled across it as I was looking up the number 39. I just thought that was awesome. So, enough about that. It's time for the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week or so. If anything strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list. And then the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week or two or three when I record, you lucky dogs. So let's check out that master list. First up, it's time to visit my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide.
Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, then I am going to share it with you. And this is, as usual in my series of gaming tables, I'm going to talk about the game I just played with my kids a little bit ago. We're playing some more Pathfinder. We decided to actually play real Pathfinder this time. I could see that the kids were searching for something, and it's a little bit more detail, a little bit more crunchy stuff for them to hold on to, and they're getting to the point where they like that. The kids are 6 and 9 at this point, for those of you who aren't familiar with my children, my younger two. And so we decided to put together a Pathfinder game, and we're having some fun with it. But the thing that was really cool for me is I'm playing with a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, and they don't really... They know that I have a story planned for them, but they are so excited that they want to tell the story themselves. And they have awesome, awesome ideas for what's going to happen in this game. So, in their first session, they are tracking some goblins through the woods. And they come across a house, a really big, oversized house. It's an ogre's house. They don't know that, but I do. There's going to be an ogre inside. Apparently the goblins, again, they don't know this, the goblins stopped here, tried to trade some of their stolen goods with the ogre, made some conversation, and then went on their way. And so the guys have a choice here of maybe trying to talk with or deal with this ogre, maybe dispatching him, maybe who knows what. He's going to be grumpy and he's going to be hard to deal with, but you know they'll have to figure that out when they get there. He's probably going to be really aggressive to start with, but who knows. So I tell him that they've got this house. Obviously someone larger than humans lives here. They're realizing there's going to be some kind of giant inside. And so they approach cautiously, and then my 9-year-old, who's trying to be all ninja-like here, he cracks the door open, he tries to peek inside, and then he starts describing it. I mean, it's like, okay, I sneak up to the door. I try and open it. Is it locked? I'm like, no, it's not locked. He's all right, cool. So he starts to open the door. He says, all right, I peek my head inside, and I can see the guy, but he's in there, and he's cooking something, and he's got his back to me, so he doesn't know that I'm here. I'm like, dude, you're getting so far ahead of me. And normally, up till now, I've always tried to say, okay, guys, you know, there's kind of this divide here between player and game master, and you know, I'll tell you what you're going to see, and I'll give the reveals, and I'll show you. But then I thought, but, you know, that's not bad. That, I mean, if that's the way he wants his story to go, why would I stop that? I can absolutely work with this, and I can absolutely make this a really cool encounter using exactly the details he just gave me. So I still made it an ogre. He's still in there, but he is actually cooking something. And I decided, based on this description, I decided he's wearing a big apron. When that made the negotiations go completely differently than I expected, because there's nobody who's really terribly ferocious when they're wearing an apron. Well, except maybe Chef Ramsay. But other than that, so, and it just made things really different. And they still wound up kind of tangling with him. It wasn't like an all-out fight, but they wound up tripping him up and slamming the door in his face. And it became more of a slapstick sort of comedy than the all-out battle that I thought it was going to be, which turned out awesome. Because while, okay, an all-out battle would have been great, and they would have had an awesome time, and they would have killed an ogre or something like that. Instead, they wound up having some back and forth. They traded a little bit of wit with him, and then they had this big slapstick scene, which made them feel like massive heroes. That was awesome for them. They got him all tripped up. It was funny, and they got to walk away from it talking about how cool that whole thing was. And they got away, and everything was cool, and they had a great time. So I let them do it. I mean, I've never done that before. It's weird to me to give the players the ability to just throw in whatever they want at any point. And again, there's got to be limits on it. But, you know, later on, the 6-year-old, who up until now, the 6-year-old does not pay attention to the games really well. He kind of listens a little bit, he pitches in, and then, oh, wait, you're talking for more than 30 seconds? You know what? I'm busy over here doing something else. And then he kind of gets lost and doesn't know what's going on. He's just not as interested in us as he is in whatever he's working on. So as they're tracking these goblins further past the ogre's house, the 6-year-old suddenly pipes up with, hey, as we're walking on the side of the road, I find one of their wagon wheels, the wheel off their cart. I find it, and it's like half buried in the dirt, and I think it's broken. I'm like, really? And he looks and he goes, well, yeah, it looks like this. And he's drawn a picture for me of the wagon wheel laying beside the side of the path. He's drawn it on the battle map, and he's put a little wagon wheel on there. I'm like, well, all right, dude, I guess if you're gonna draw pictures, I got to give it to you. So now I've had to change up the whole goblins' plan, because the whole idea was that the goblins got back safely to their lair. The guys are going to track them all the way there, and then they're going to have to go through a lair full of traps and goblin guards and this kind of stuff. But instead, well, their wagon wheel broke, so that means the goblins couldn't pull their cart any further, so the goblins have abandoned the cart and hidden most of the goods in the woods somewhere. But the kids don't know this. Right, and so now the goblins have gone back to their lair to get help. So even if the guys get there while they're still in the lair, they're not going to find any of their stuff. They're going to have to figure out where it went. or alternately, the goblins have gotten back to their lair, they've gotten a new card, a bunch of reinforcements, and they're on their way back to find where the stuff is, and the guys are going to run across them going the other way. All right, and so now, my entire plot, because he said he found a wagon wheel, my entire plot just became about 3,000% more interesting than what I originally planned. There's a lot more complication in here, and it's stuff that they did for me. I didn't even have to do nothing. And it's still, it is nerve-wracking for me, because I have never done this. I mean, there's games out there. I know that there's lots of games that allow you to give up narrative control to players, either because, you know, they've bid for it, or they have, you know, there's some special mechanic in the rules or some special power that allows them to take over and just insert stuff into the game. And I know it's out there. And I talk a big game, and I have always wanted to put stuff like that into my games, give people the ability to use that, but I've never really done it. I mean, maybe in minor ways, maybe, but never really done it. But now, my younger kids just assume that that's what they're going to do, and I haven't set about correcting them on it yet. And so we've played a couple of sessions since then, and they continue to do it. And I'm not stopping them. I'm really still working with it, and it makes me nervous every time. And it's that gut reaction of they're stepping on my toes. They're getting into my territory. This is my job. What am I as a GM if I'm not the guy who makes all the background stuff up? If I, you know, the guy who controls all the NPCs and tells you, it's just odd. But I guess in a way I was kind of asking for it, because I have for a long time gotten to the point where, you know, they run across something, anything. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a person, an enemy, a town, and I will just say, and the name of this town is, and I'll look at them. And then they'll give me a cool name, and so I'll write it down on my notes, and I'll put it down on the, yeah, I have a little corner of the battle map where I put a bunch of stuff like that so that they can, it's like a group memory so they can kind of see it as well. But you know, when a bad guy comes up or someone they need to negotiate with, a lot of times I haven't thought of any names ahead of time, so I just ask them, and what's this guy's name? And sometimes they give me something good, sometimes they give me something dumb, and maybe we take a variant on that, or maybe we just leave the dumb name. Doesn't matter. And so, and that's, like I say, that's little stuff. But I've always done that with them, and I guess that's kind of, I don't know if that's encouraged them to add their own, or if that's just in the nature of an imaginative little kid like that, that they're just, they want to tell a story. They really badly want to tell a story. And they understand that, you know, there's a game master and there's dice and there's a whole process here. But more than anything, they just want to tell a story. And I've decided, as much as it really hurts me, and it really does, it is so difficult, I'm making a strong effort to just step back and let them tell the story they want to tell. If they've got the ideas, I'll let them run with them. And if it's something that's going to be really unworkable, then, okay, we'll use it as best we can, or maybe this time I'll say, ah, you know what, I've already got something planned. Let's see what I've got, you know, that kind of thing. So we kind of, it's a compromise, but I'm really excited about it. It's new for me, and I know a lot of you are sitting back going, oh, yeah, well, that's just like, I don't know, Dogs in the Vineyard, or, which I don't even know if Dogs in the Vineyard has that sort of control in it. I have no idea. I'm just saying, a lot of you have played games that do this. You've played Amber Diceless, where you bid for control of stuff. You've played all sorts of games, and you're all sitting back going, see? Well, you're like a baby, Mike. You're just starting on this? Really? Okay, I know. But for me, it's new, and it's just, there's a kind of wonder to it. And so I'm really liking it. And, you know, obviously, I can't shut up about my kids, so I'll tell you more later. But now...
Ooh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
That's right, that music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something, because it's the Science Corner. I love the Science Corner. And I already had a Science Corner ready for you, and I will still give you that one, but I've now had to make this a Science Corner double feature, because we've got warp drives. I can't go without mentioning warp drives, right? Okay, let me clarify. We don't actually have warp drives yet. But we're looking at the very real possibility that 100 years from now, we might. I'm not even kidding about this. All right? Zefram Cochrane may really, in 2065, come up with a warp drive and send us out to meet the Vulcans. It could happen, people. I'm not kidding about this. All right. Let me explain. The idea here is the ability to create a warp drive, the ability to travel through space at faster than the speed of light, and yet somehow do it without violating Einstein's theory of relativity, which is pretty damn immutable at this point. It's inviolable. You don't go faster than the speed of light. And yet, there's a way to trick space-time and let it get you there faster than it thought it could. All right, this is great. And this has been known for a while, since early 90s, 94, something like that. Anyway, the Alcubierre drive, or Alcubierre, I don't know how it's pronounced, but the theory, the math behind it was that you could actually warp space around you. Your ship with its huge Alcubierre, whatever it is, with your big warp drive on it, your ship with your warp drive sits in a protected bubble of normal space. But all around that bubble, you are warping space so that space-time in front of your ship contracts and space-time behind your ship expands rapidly. Because, this is the magic, relativity says you can't travel through space at faster than the speed of light. All right, great, we won't. But it also allows for space itself to expand and contract, which it obviously, you know, at the Big Bang we had, rapid expansion of the entire universe, and the universe itself is still expanding, not just things flying away from each other through space, but quite literally the space-time itself, the fabric of space-time that we live in, is itself expanding and carrying stuff with it. So that there is stuff that, for all intents and purposes, is, you know, billions of light years away from us, and it is traveling away from us at faster than the speed of light, but not because it's traveling itself faster than the speed of light. It's traveling pretty rapidly away from us, but also space-time is expanding fast enough that the space between us and them is expanding so quickly, it's adding extra distance, as well as the speed that's already going. Does that make any sense? All right, so effectively, it appears to be traveling faster than the speed of light. Well, actually, it doesn't appear to be anything, because since it is going that fast, we don't see it anymore. All right, the light from it can't reach us because the expanding space in between expands too rapidly for the light to ever reach us, no matter how long we wait for it. It just won't get here. All right, so that's the boundary, the effective for us boundary of space-time, where stuff is that we will just never see and never get to. All right, I've wandered a little bit afield. The whole point is, relativity allows for the expansion and contraction of space-time, and even though it tells you that you can't move through space faster than the speed of light, you can expand and contract space, if you have enough energy, at any damn speed you want. Aha! Now we're on to it. So, with your expanding bubble of space-time behind you and the contraction in front of you, you're essentially moving the space you're in. Yeah, sort of. Anyway, there's other people that can explain it better than me, but you have now warped space and allowed you to get to, let's say, Alpha Centauri is a great example because it's the closest star to us. You get to Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away, and you make it there in, say, 3 weeks. That's pretty cool. All right. So that, again, back in 94, 95, whatever it was, we had the math that told us that, hey, this is theoretically possible. We can do this without violating relativity. And then they calculate our energy needs, and they go, oh, well, and all it would take is for us to convert the entire mass of the planet Jupiter into energy, according to E equals MC squared, and that should about power us there. All right, so it's maybe a little bit much. So we've known about it for almost 20 years, but we've also known about it in the sense that, well, yeah, but there, even at the rate at which we continue to increase our energy production and increase our energy consumption, we are never getting to the point where we're going to use up an entire planet the size of Jupiter just to get somewhere. That's not going to happen. So we've looked at it as theoretically possible, practically never, ever, ever going to be there. All right, that just changed. And when I say just changed, I mean it just appeared on the nerdy news sites that I follow, which means it could have happened 6 months ago that we finally got the new math. I don't know exactly when. But the new math that goes with this, they found a new way to do it by varying the rate of expansion contraction, something, I don't know, put a spin on it, maybe, I don't know. I have no idea what they're doing. But they've changed the math, they've come up with a new method, and it's still the same principle of this same warp drive. But now, we could get to Alpha Centauri on the energy of, the example they gave, because they wanted to keep it space-related, is the mass energy contained within the original Voyager spacecraft, which, if you look that up, is about 1,600 pounds, less than a ton of matter converted completely from matter into energy, would give us the energy to get to Alpha Centauri. Now, we have absolutely no way of doing that right now. Even if we got all the stuff to work out, to actually make the warp drive go, we can't do it. It's, imagine that you went back to the 1950s and you told someone that, yeah, well, I have a time machine and it'll get us there, but I need 1.21 gigawatts of energy to get back. And they'd go, 1.21 gigawatts? Great, Scott! They're impossible! Impossible! All right, yeah, well, it seems impossible now. And we would call it gigawatts at this point. But it's something that is theoretically feasible, doable. I can see, you know, 100 years from now, us being able to convert that much matter into energy, or finding a source that gives us the equivalent amount of energy and get us on our way. That's what our antimatter drives are for, right? That's why Star Trek has them, to power their warp drives. All right. All this is going to work out for me. In modern terms, I mean, let's just look at it. I went out and I had to do a little bit of research. And you know how I hate doing research, but for you guys, this one time. And the mass energy contained within 1,600 pounds of matter would be roughly equivalent to 10% of the total world output of energy in a given year. So take all of the energy created by the entire Earth, used by all of the human beings on Earth, all right, and one-tenth of that for a year. All right, so let's say 5 weeks worth of energy, 5 weeks worth of the entire output of the Earth. That's what it would take to get us to Alpha Centauri. That, you know what? That's doable. 100 years from now, that is doable. And of course, this is all on paper right now. NASA is actually, God bless them, setting up experiments to start testing the concept of warping space, to actually do it on a really, really small scale. But they're actually working on doing it. Just, this is the proof of concept. This is the test. And then, yeah, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years from now, I don't know. We'll get to the level where we can use that, create that amount of energy, or maybe even find, I mean, this is, we just cut the energy that we would need to a bare sliver of a fraction of a percentage point of what we were talking about 20 years ago. So who knows how well we can improve it, what kind of efficiency we can get out of it in, you know, another 20 years. So I'm telling you, warp drives are going to be real, all right? This maybe not exactly correct right now. Maybe this math isn't going to work out ultimately, but it will someday. That's the optimist in me. I know it will. We're going to do this, and we're not going to be – I've always had this vision because of the limit of relativity. I've always had this vision that we will be grand space explorers at some point, but really our grand space exploration will be limited to us, you know, filling up and colonizing our solar system. And, you know, we'll send out robot probes and, you know, spaceships and other stuff. And we'll send stuff out to other stars, but not people. People will never be willing to risk that kind of time investment for themselves and that sort of risk to their physical person, especially once we perfect immortality. You would think that once you're immortal, you're like, well, sure, once I'm immortal, now I can take that 300-year trip over to the next star because I'm immortal. What do I care, right? Not so, my friend, because once you're immortal, you have got way more to lose. I mean, once you're immortal, are you really going to put that physical shell into this fragile little ship? Even if you're talking about, you know, a 3-mile-long colony ship, you're going to put that out into the cold, dark vacuum of space between stars and risk your one body on a trip like this? No, you've got much more to protect at this point. So, but if you could do it in 3 weeks, hell yeah, we're all going. That's what I'm telling you. So anyway, I'm just excited. You know how I love space travel. You know how I love NASA, and I want us to get out there and be doing stuff. And just to see that this is even possible, that is just too much for me. I about peed myself when I found out. And if you didn't pee yourself, shame on you. Go, or you know what? I'll wait. Go pee yourself now. All right. But next up, well, it's still the science corner. Okay, here's my other science corner. And this is the original one I had planned before warp drives completely distracted me and drove me over the brink of insanity. in, this is a report, documentary, article, something from BBC One. I can't remember the whole details of where I got it from. But using fMRI scans on people who are in comas, they are getting from some people in comas, not all, some people who are thought to be, have been diagnosed to be in some level of vegetative state, they are able to ask questions of the person and get responses from their brains showing that they are aware of you, showing that they are responding to your stimuli. And in fact, more than that, because, okay, all right, you know, I can see vegetative state, but they still, you know, the brain shows some, you know, random firings in response to auditory stimulus or whatever. Okay, great. I'll give you that. But not just that, but we can ask you questions, and with a lot of work back and forth, and it takes some training and some patience with a lot of work, you can, in your mind, think the answers that you want to give us, yes or no, mostly. I'm sure this is mostly just positive and negative. All right, it's a binary function. You're not getting the whole conversation here, but you can give us a yes or a no to questions that we ask you while you're in a coma. Some people can't. That is fascinating. Holy crap. And not just that they're giving us a yes and a no. I mean, they're answering specific questions. Some of them, for example, and this is the guy that was featured here, a guy named Scott Routley. This is in Canada. And some British neuroscientist, I have his name here, hold on, Professor Adrian Owen. He leads the team at the Brain and Mind Institute. So if that is not a smart bunch, I don't know who is. And they were talking to Scott Routley, and they were able to get real yes and no answers out of him for stuff, and stuff that you know, specific things about himself, his life, what he knows, what he doesn't know, enough that this isn't just random workings here. He's actually responding to them. The idea that he would randomly pick the correct answers to some of these questions over the number of times they've tried talking with him, the idea that he would randomly get the right answer all this time is statistically insignificant. So he's there, and he's listening, and he's responding. Awesome. There was another guy, and I didn't write down his name, but another guy that when he went into his coma, he had some car accident. It's always a car accident, it seems, with these guys. When he went into his coma, his sister had not yet had a baby, all right? His sister was, I think, married but hadn't yet had a child, wasn't even pregnant at that point. And then while he was in the coma, she did become pregnant, and she did have a baby, and the family visits him all the time, and they talk about the stuff that's going on in their lives, and they talk about things that are happening to him. And they had talked to him. So when they asked him questions and they're going through all this stuff, they asked him specifically, does your sister have a child? And he said, yeah, she does. Which shows that not just that his brain, that he's in there and responding to our questions, but that he's been picking up knowledge while he's in the coma. He's actually picking up and storing new memories while he's unconscious. Which, okay, on the one hand, awesome. Unbelievably awesome that we can communicate with someone like this. And not all of them. I mean, they had lots and lots of subjects, and some of them, now you got nothing. Or some of them, you know, they got good days and they got bad days. But spectacular that this is just the beginning of something huge, all right? But on the other hand, the idea of being trapped in your head and being able to hear people around you, and you can hear them talking, and you know they're talking to you, and describing everything going on in their lives, and knowing the things that you're missing with your family and with your friends. And there's something really tragic about that, too. And to me, this is a really particular fear for me. All right, have you ever had a dream where, or it's not even a dream at this point, have you ever woken up and your mind is now awake, but whatever that trigger is that shuts off your body's ability to flail around in the middle of the night, that hasn't released yet. So you're awake, but you can't get your body to move yet. It's like you're just almost awake, because there's some portion of your brain that basically shuts off your body so that whatever you're dreaming, you don't actually get up and walk around and flail and hurt yourself while you sleep. This is a good thing. your body is shut off, and then when you wake up, it turns it all back on. And obviously some people sleepwalk, and some people do thrash around in their sleep, and some people don't have that part isn't working perfectly, or things slip through at times. Whatever, okay. But for most people, it's a pretty simple function. And me, once in a long while, maybe every 2 or 3 years, I will have, and then once it happens, it will usually happen like 2 or 3 days in a row, where I will wake up after a nap, or waking up in the morning. It's usually after a nap. And so I've laid down to take a nap. I wake up an hour later, and I am awake. In my head, I'm completely awake. I know I'm sleeping, and in fact, I know I'm sleeping, and I can feel my face, and I can feel my arms, so I know what position I'm laying in. All I need to do is get up now, and for the life of me, no matter how hard I try, I can't move. I can't move anything. And in these particular moments, my response to that is sheer panic. And I do everything I can. Is the idea of concentrating all of my will on that one hand just to make it move, just to make it jump. And finally, I will push hard enough, and it usually takes me a few minutes, and finally I'll push hard enough, and that one hand will move, and now I'm completely awake, up, everything's turned back on, I'm fine. Oh my God, that scares me to death. All right? So now, imagine that I've been in an accident, and I'm in a coma, and I can hear everyone talking to me and telling me all the things that are going on, and no matter how hard I push, for hours or days, that hand is not moving. My eyes aren't opening. I'm nothing. And I suppose, after a time, there has to be some sort of acceptance of this, but, man, I suppose if I go out there are people who have been in comas and have mentioned that they had some sort of awareness while they were in comas, and they can relate to you their experience now of what happened to them while they were there. And I suppose if I went out and looked, there's probably all sorts of interviews and studies and things that would tell me about it, but I haven't done that because it kind of creeps me out and I'm a little bit scared. But anyway, the positive part is we can actually start communicating with them. Maybe that would make it a little bit easier, yes? I mean, at least, all right, I still can't get my eyes to open, I still can't move that damn hand, but I can get some recognition. Oh, at least I can, even if it's in the smallest of form, I can actually communicate with someone and show that I'm still here and make myself known. Oh, that would be kind of cool, right? Whew, all right, so we got a little something. Now it's time for Roku! I love my Roku. Roku is the internet-capable box that I use to watch my Netflix Instant Watch on. And I love my Roku. I love my Netflix Instant Watch. It's awesome stuff. So, what have I been watching lately? All right, first off, I went through the first 2 seasons of Walking Dead. And we went through it obsessively. Nadia and I just couldn't turn it off. And we went through it quick. And Walking Dead is just as good as everyone tells us. And I know some of you have been watching it from the very beginning. And you're just glad I'm caught up. I know. Thank you. But I have got to highly recommend Walking Dead to anybody. Go watch it. The only problem I have with Walking Dead, honestly, because, all right, I've read some reviews and I've read some commentary, and a lot of people had some real serious complaints about Walking Dead, especially about season 2, that it seemed, at least from the impression I got, that they felt it was kind of random and that they were killing off important people seemingly willy-nilly, that you've just had time to get to know and love this particular character, and oh, now they go off and okay. Maybe, but I don't see that watching it all as a unit. And I found this with a lot of TV shows, the serial stuff that you kind of have to, the continuing storyline from week to week, you really have to follow it straight through. I found with a lot of stuff like that, that when you watch it all back to back, you know, you actually get to see all 12 episodes of a season in, you know, the course of just a few days, way better than having to wait week to week to see them and trying to get caught up on everything. Because it all makes more sense. I didn't have the kind of issues with season 2 that a lot of people complained about. Yeah, I mean, obviously every show's got some flaws, but I loved Walking Dead, both seasons that I've seen. And I understand season 3 is out right now, and they are not making it easy to watch this. If you don't watch it when they air it, you're kind of stuck. They're not putting it out on the net. I know any show that I wanted to watch, I know I could go out there and I could illegally stream it from somewhere, But I'm not into that. I just don't do it. So I'm just going to wait for it to come out on Instant Watch. Or if it doesn't come out on Instant Watch, I'll get it on DVD because I want to see it that bad. I guess my only complaint about Walking Dead at this point is that you can't keep away from Walking Dead spoilers. And I'm not even going to tell you what some of them are because I know just like two things so far about Season 3 that are so huge that it's kind of ruined a little bit of Season 3 for me. And I haven't even, I'm like 6 months, a year away from watching Season 3. And already I have a couple of things that, oh, darn it, really? I wish I had gone into it not knowing that. Darn it. And I actively try and stay away from spoilers. I make a conscious effort to try and know as little as possible about things that I watch before I watch them because I want to take it in fresh. I want to be surprised by stuff. And so I'm actively avoiding spoilers, and yet you can't keep away from Walking Dead. It's that pervasive. But also, if you haven't seen American Horror Story, I recommend it. Is it as good a show? Maybe not quite, but it's pretty darn good. All right, American Horror Story is an FX series, highly charged, very sexual, very gory, very a lot of things. It is a very, very grown-up show. And I think I watched an episode of it accidentally like 6 months ago, and I even mentioned it on the podcast. And it's as good as I was hoping. It's really entertaining, and it's a ghost story. It's a house that has a very checkered past and a haunted origin, and now there are lots and lots of ghosts involved, and man, they are active and mean, and some of them are kind of hot, and a very convoluted storyline that has me absolutely hanging on with every episode, trying to put this puzzle together, and I've only got like 3 more episodes to go on season 1. And I'm just hooked into this thing. I really recommend American Horror Story. Good show to watch. To go along with it, though, and this is apparently season 1 wraps up the story, and it's done at the end of season 1. So what's season 2? This is the part I love. Season 2, brand new story. American Horror Story Asylum. And so it's going to be, they're bringing forward, you know, 7, 8, 9 of the same cast members, but they're all cast in brand new roles. It's a brand new story, and instead of a haunted house, we now have a haunted insane asylum. This is the kind of thing that I've wanted to see for a long time, the idea that you have an ongoing series that explores different stories, that they don't have to stick with that same set of characters every single time. You know, once they've served their purpose, they've played out their role, great. Now we move on, but same series, same theme, but we tell a new story. I wish Heroes had done that. That was the original intent with the TV show Heroes, is that season 1 would be all the people that we saw, and then starting season 2, well, okay, maybe some of them would still be around in the background, or we'd have one or two carryover characters. But for the most part, season 2 was supposed to start fresh, brand new set of heroes, brand new set of origin stories, brand new storyline, keep things going, keep things fresh. I wish they had done that. I so wish they had. Season 1 of Heroes was pretty awesome right up until about the last 10 minutes. And I loved that. And then I felt like seasons 2, 3, 4, I felt like they were really struggling to try and find ways to keep, because so many of the characters gained these massive, massive power levels that were really uncontrollable, and so they had to find new ways to change the characters. I mean, Siler went through how many complete and total personality changes through this entire thing? Just ridiculous how often this guy switched out his personalities. And so, you know, and they had to do things to control these unrealistic power levels and bring things back down to somewhere where we can actually have a real challenge and that we can actually interact with other people. And I wish they hadn't bothered. I wish they just started over with new characters like they originally planned. Well, American Horror Story listened to me, apparently, because they love my podcast, and they're doing exactly that. That we played out our story, we're done. All right, these cast members, we love them, we love working with them, we will keep them on, but we'll give them all new roles, all new story. It's the same theme, the same, I'm assuming it'll be the same kind of world with the same kind of rules, but it doesn't have to be. So anyway, American Horror Story, good stuff. I'll be done with it probably in the next couple of days as I finish up these last 3 episodes. But I am loving American Horror Story, and my wife as well. We've been watching this one together. Loving it, and I can't wait to see Asylum, which again, who knows when it'll be on Instant Watch. I'm certainly not catching it live, so who knows when I'll ever get to see that one. But I love my Roku. So let's see what we have for our Nerd Culture Report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, Gonzo, but you're very, very close. This is the Nerd Culture Report. Last week I told you that I was going to bring you a report on George Takei. And by God, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I love this man. George Takei is pure awesome. He really is. All right, first off, well, you know what? Let me give you a little history of George Takei. I actually almost considered putting this in the Unnamed History segment because it's the history of this man. But he's still alive and still active, and I just want to talk about how cool he is. So, Nerd Culture Report. George Takei, born to a father who loved anything British. All right, that was his dad's thing. He loved the English. And George himself, George, was named after King George VI of England, who was actually crowned, I think, like a month after George was born. George Takei, not the King George. Anyway, he was actually named for George VI of England. And Takei also, interestingly, as long as I mentioned his father, his mother's maiden name, Nakamura. Where do you know that from? That's right, Hiro Nakamura. That was actually George Takei's name in the show Heroes. Well, Hiro Nakamura was his son, but he was also obviously a Nakamura because it was his father. All right, that was his mom's maiden name. And of course, all of us know him because he was Sulu on Star Trek. Hikaru Sulu was his name. And we all love him for that. But before that, before Star Trek even, all right, this man was a classically trained Shakespearean actor. All right, he actually trained at the Shakespeare Institute at Stratford-upon-Avon in England. That's how serious he was about being a Shakespearean actor. And as a classically trained actor, there weren't a ton of roles for Asian dudes in Hollywood at that time. This was, you know, back in the 40s. But of the roles that there were, he got a lot of them because he was good at what he did. Really good. I mean, this is all before Star Trek. He worked in a ton of movies, and he actually got to work right alongside with people like Richard Burton, Cary Grant, John Wayne, and most importantly to us, Alec Guinness. So back before Sulu was Sulu, and back before Ben Kenobi was Ben Kenobi, the two of them worked together in movies. I just think that's kind of cool. But he obviously was Sulu, and in classic Star Trek, and we all love him for that. But here's where I really first started turning on to George Takei. I heard him in an interview, and among all of the other things he talked about his political activity. He apparently has always been politically minded. You know him today as an outspoken gay advocate, and you know he's been all over because of that. I'll get to more on that later. But way back in the 70s, back in 1972, he was actually involved in the Democratic National Convention as either a delegate or an alternate delegate or something like that. He ran for city council in Los Angeles, and when he was running for city council, this is straight out of Wikipedia, by the way, when he was running for city council, his opponents demanded that the Star Trek cartoon not be run on TV in Los Angeles while the campaign was going on because it would give him an unfair advantage and they wouldn't be able to offer equal time for others because his voice is so distinctive. And so even in cartoon form with his voice on top of it, that was just too much. They couldn't compete with that. Well, he still wound up losing. But he did get appointed by the mayor of Los Angeles to the board of the Southern California Rapid Transit District. Right, these are the people who are working on the subways and the buses and who knows what else. And this was what I heard from him in an interview. This was a radio interview, and he was talking about his time with the Rapid Transit Authority, where he served for 11 years in that job. And this was the thing, of everything he talked about from his earlier career, this was the thing he was most proud of in his life, because through his actions, he was there to help plan and initiate the entire subway system in Los Angeles. He motivated that, helped bring in the money, got it all going. That was his baby. And he was so proud of that. And I thought, God, that is cool. How awesome is that? I mean, we're talking about Sulu here. We're talking about a man who had to suffer through working with William Shatner day to day and who has been through all this other stuff. And yet, for him, It was the Rapid Transit Authority. He loved that. It was something very physical that he accomplished, and he made it happen. He was really happy about that. I thought it was cool. All right. Now, since then, yeah, we know Sulu. We know Kaido Nakamura from Heroes. He's had all sorts of acting roles. Now he's actually on Howard Stern, which still baffles me. I like him on Stern because I like Takei on just about anything. I really have no problem with that. But if you look at his gay activism, because, okay, obviously, for those of you who didn't know, spoiler alert, George Takei is gay, and he's married to a partner he's been with for, I think, 20 years, something like that. It doesn't make any difference. But go on YouTube and do a YouTube search for George Takei PSA, for public service announcement. Do that search, all right? And the first result that is going to come up for George Takei PSA when you search on YouTube is one that says George Takei addresses Arkansas school board member Clint McCants. I'll name him by name because the guy's a douchebag, all right? And what happens in this video is amazing. This is a public service announcement that George Takei made in response to this douchebag Clint McCants. And then released, and they actually aired it, and now it runs on YouTube, and you can go look at it, and you will love this. You'll be thrilled to death watching this. Because Clint McCants apparently made some really homophobic anti-gay comments. Talked about, he encouraged gay people. This is a school board member. And not that school board member is this huge, high, important position, but they are influential, and they're dealing with the education of our children, for God's sake. And Clint McCants, in speaking about gays, said something along the lines of gay suicide rates. He's glad he encourages them to kill themselves because that's one less gay in the world. He went even further and said that he's actually happy when he hears that gay people give each other AIDS and die. Just horrible, idiotic things. And then he later tried to apologize and backtrack for it, but it doesn't matter. He's no longer a school board member and will never serve in a public capacity ever again because he's an idiot. But George Takei makes this PSA video to basically tell young gay people, gay students specifically, that you don't have to listen to that, you don't have to put up with that crap, and specifically says, because Clint McCants, you are a douchebag. Except he says it, not me doing a really weak, lame imitation of George Takei, but he says it in George Takei's voice. And he says, douchebag. All right? And he calls him a douchebag repeatedly through this video. And then implies that, look, I understand that you've got all this homophobia and this hatred in you, but you shouldn't hate, and you certainly should never wish another human being dead, ever, for any reason. And I suspect that your hatred comes from maybe there's something secret and hidden within yourself, and you're just afraid to admit it right now. And that's okay. But, one day when you wake up with some gay boy in a hotel room and there's a huge scandal on TV and you're contemplating suicide, I hope you don't do it because I don't wish you dead. I would never wish that on anybody. So, and he's just wonderful. George Takei is amazing. And you know what? I shouldn't even have spoiled it. I shouldn't have given you the whole PSA right there because you need to go watch it and love it because George Takei is that cool. All right, and then, look, you've already got YouTube open, right? So as long as you're doing it, go ahead and look up on YouTube, It's Okay to Be Takei. This is the best thing he's ever done. I love this video. It's another PSA. Apparently, some area, Arizona maybe? I don't remember who it was. Colorado? Anyway, some locality was trying to pass a law, and it was a town thing, a local thing. Maybe it was even school again. Where they wanted to ban teachers from talking about the gay lifestyle in any way. They weren't allowed to discuss homosexuality in the classroom in any capacity. And it was referred to at the time as the Don't Say Gay Law, that you're just not allowed to say gay. And this seemed, correctly, very horribly oppressive and small-minded and bigoted. And so George Takei makes this video, the It's Okay to Be Takei. And he says, look, this is just wrong, but if they get this law passed and you're not allowed to say gay, then tell you what, I will lend my name to the cause. From now on, anytime you would say gay, just say Takei. All right? And it makes everything. Then you can talk about Takei marriage. Or put, if you're feeling festive, you could march in a TK Pride parade. And even homophobic slurs don't sound so bad when you substitute it. For example, that's so TK. He's awesome. All right. There's more to it, but I'm only going to spoil that first half. Go watch it. The man is awesome. He really is. And all of this, again, this is a guy who, when he was a kid, he grew up for 3 years in a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. That's the part that just slays me. All right. So from the age of 5 to the age of 8, he's living in an American internment camp. And yet, he is the most relentlessly positive and optimistic human being I have ever seen in my life. And that's the magic of it for me. Listen to him on Howard Stern. I can't listen to Howard Stern because Howard Stern is, even when he's in a good mood, Howard Stern is one of the most negative people in the world. He is just bitter and pessimistic and spiteful and just sad all the time. And it brings me down. It is just such a negative energy. But you put George Takei on there. George Takei is great, and he brings a good balance to that show because nothing brings George Takei down, ever. I love George Takei for his positivity the same way I love Ellen DeGeneres for her positivity, and maybe there's something with my obsession with gay icons, I don't know, but you ever watch The Ellen Show? I love Ellen, because Ellen is just happy all the time. She just brings joy. She plays pranks and she does stuff, but she's not mean. Ellen DeGeneres on her show is never ever mean. She's just fun and joyful and wonderful. And she's married to Portia de Rossi. Oh, lucky woman. But it's that kind of positivity. And that's what I love about George Takei, is the man is just a superior human being. He is just a wonderful dude. I can't, like I say, go out and look up his stuff on YouTube especially. That's something that you can do right now, and you can spend 10 minutes laughing, and you will have a great time. And you'll thank me, and you'll thank George Takei. Send him a letter. Tell him how cool he is. I have always told you guys that the best way to get a hold of me is to sign up for our forums and come and play with us, because we have a really good time out there, right? And so therefore, now it is time to dig into those forums a little bit, because I don't do this segment nearly often enough. It's time for Write Said Thread. I'm too sexy for my forums. Too sexy for my forums. The way I'm Discord dancing. That's right. Write Said Thread, where I just take a thread that has been making me giggle for the last week, and I share with you the highlights of it, because I just love it. This is yet another thread that I started. And the title of the thread, I can't remember the name of that forum. I am having a mental block here today. This is killing me. Anyway, it's in our Nerd Babble forum section, and it is a thread entitled Movie Titles with Diarrhea. Yeah. My friend Thorn posted this on her Facebook page, and she actually got it from a Twitter tag. It's hashtag add with diarrhea to a movie title. That's the Twitter feed for it. And the rules of this game are really simple. Take a movie title, and then add with diarrhea to the end of it, and then see how funny it is. All right? Most movies work when you do this. There's a few that don't, and there's a few that work, but they're not all that great. But, for example, you get Three Men and a Baby with Diarrhea. Great. 12 Angry Men with Diarrhea. All right, we get it. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with Diarrhea. Yeah, see? All right, this is the most juvenile, stupid, idiotic game ever, and yet I can't stop. Whenever I get a movie title, I add diarrhea to it now. It's just like when you open a fortune cookie and you read your fortune and then you have to add in bed to the end of it. You can't not do it. All right, well, with diarrhea is now stuck in my head, and I know it's idiotic, and yet it makes me giggle all the time. All right, and so I posted this up. My favorite, and this I posted this one up, but it's actually from Kaz, who is Thorne's husband. Kaz put up Scent of a Woman with Diarrhea. I love that one. And there are hundreds of them already posted in our thread, and if you follow the Twitter feed, I'm guessing that pretty much every one of them that we've done, someone else has already done, because there's only,
if you look at the popular movies out there, everyone's going to hit these. All right, but from our thread, some of my absolute favorites from the list, Stan put up Life is Beautiful with Diarrhea. So true. Another one from me, and I just like tooting my own horn because this was an awesome one. But from me, Some Like It Hot with Diarrhea. Yeah, see, I'm a funny guy. Eliahad posted up Dirty Dancing with Diarrhea. Green Chelonia, because she knows I love this movie, and she posted up Shakespeare in Love with Diarrhea. All right, and she posted up just for me. She said, this one's for you, Mike. And at first, I didn't get it. All right, Shakespeare in Love with Diarrhea. Okay, so Shakespeare's got diarrhea, and he's in love. Whatever. And I kind of glossed over it. I'm really glad she put it up because, you know, it is one of my favorite movies. But as I'm going back and I'm compiling this list to do this for the podcast, I realized, no, wait, no, Shakespeare doesn't have diarrhea while he's in love. Shakespeare is actually in love with diarrhea. He loves diarrhea. That's funny. Okay, now it's making me laugh all over again. Shakespeare in love with diarrhea. And so I'm trying to tell my kids about this. And Italian gets it right away, and he loves it, and he's participating with me. All right, Gygax, on the other hand, every single one of my, and I mean, I'm throwing out the best ones. I'm throwing out these here and some other really, really good ones. And I'm throwing them at him, and all he'll do is give me that grin, that smile that you give someone when someone makes a joke, but it's idiotic, but you give them that smile and a little a little fake laugh that indicates, that, oh, yeah, I recognize that that's your joke and it's supposed to be funny, but okay, I'm busy. Go away. And so, like I say, he's humoring me a little bit, but he's clearly acting as if he is way too mature for this. He can't believe how juvenile I'm being. Seriously, Dad, is this really how you're going to get your laughs today? You've got to stop this. All right. And I keep throwing them at him, and I'm getting nothing. And I'm ready to give up. And out of nowhere, he goes, Zach and Miri make a porno? And I'm rolling. Oh, Zach and Miri make a porno with diarrhea. I love that. I think that has to be my absolute favorite of all the ones we've done. Anyway, like I say, there are hundreds of them. If you want to see more, think of any movie and you'll pretty much get all of them yourself. Or, like I say, come visit our forums, take a look at the thread, go out to Twitter, look up that hashtag. There's lots of ways you can find this, but it's a fun game. And once you've started doing it, it's tough to stop. It really is. And every time I think, okay, yeah, like I'll see a massive list of them and I'll read through all of them. I'm like, okay, you know what? This is kind of played out. And then I'll get that one at the end that, oh, nope, that's funny. All right. I get it. Skyfall with diarrhea. Up with diarrhea. All right. I'm 12. I get it. I don't care. It's still funny. And now the moment you've all been waiting for. If I had a drum, I'd give you a drum roll. It's the badass movie quote of the week. All right. Quote. We go by many names and take many forms. We bring wonder and hope. We bring joy and dreams. We are the Sandman and the Tooth Fairy. We are the Easter Bunny. And Santa, and our powers are greater than you ever imagine. Unquote. End quote. All right, there we go. Yeah, okay, that's me doing my really bad imitation of Alec Baldwin, doing his not-so-bad Russian Santa Claus impression in the movie Rise of the Guardians. Which, okay, now, even with the Russian accent, that's not necessarily a totally badass line all by itself, just as I read it to you there. But when you're watching the movie and you get the visuals, oh, yeah, this is the most badass Santa you've ever seen. All right, muscle-bound like Thor, big old tattoos on his forearms, a sword in each hand Santa. That's the Santa we're looking at, all right? Even the Easter Bunny, Hugh Jackman brings it for the Easter Bunny, and the dude is badass. By the way, did I tell you I saw Rise of the Guardians and I really, really liked it? Oh, God, you've got to see this, and go see it in the theater. And pay the extra money to see it in 3D, and just go have a good time. And I've seen the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, and I understand that it's getting kind of it's positive. People like it, but it's not, you know, oh, it's good, but not great. All right, I get that. I see it. They're wrong. The movie is not just great, it's magical. All right? And they're talking about how, oh, it's kind of a rehashed story. Oh, it's Avengers for toddlers. Oh, it's, yeah, oh, well, you know, yes, it's entertaining for the little ones, but oh, adults won't get so much out of it. Yes, screw you. It's magic. You know what? And if you don't believe in magic, you don't belong in this movie. Get out and let me enjoy my film. What is wrong with you people? All right. Rise of the Guardians is great. It's Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy and the Sandman and their newest recruit, Jack Frost, doing badass things and fighting off the boogeyman. That's what I want. Oh, I'm having so much fun with this. And every single one of them is, including the boogeyman, is a totally killer badass. They are spectacular. Okay, except the Tooth Fairy. That's my one maybe little complaint with it is that, okay, yeah, the one woman on the team kind of seems to get short shrift. She's not quite the same level of badass as all the others, but bear in mind that, you know, she is still the Tooth Fairy. And when you've got someone who is, you know, breaking into your house, breaking into your room in the middle of the night to steal your lost body parts from underneath your pillow, I guess you don't want to make her too scary. All right? And she's powerful. And she's fun. And she's funny. And, all right, if you look at the costume that she wears, every time I saw that costume, it's this multicolored feathered thing. And every time I saw that costume, you know what I thought of? Yeah, that's right. Quetzalcoatl. God, I always have trouble with that name. Quetzalcoatl, the Mayan feathered serpent god. Oh, feathered dragon with godlike powers. All right, that's more badass. All right, I can go with that. That's what she reminded me of. And I've never been a huge fan of feathered serpents, but I do recognize the power of a serpent god. So I'll give her some credit for that one. And no matter what she's wearing, she is still way more badass than Dwayne Johnson in the tutu. Yeah, that's right, because I saw that movie in the theater, too. Oh, how I regret that one. Dwayne Johnson owes me money. Yeah, I smell what you're cooking, jerk. All right, but I'm telling you, this movie was fun. The visuals were spectacular. They created kingdoms, realms for these people that lived, and they made sense, and they took, I mean, it's still Santa. Santa drives a sleigh, Santa delivers toys, Santa is Father Christmas. We get all that. But they added just new flavor to all of it. Yeah, he's got his elves, but he's also got Yeti. Ooh, you love the Yeti. Everyone had something added to him. They're still the same recognizable characters you know, but with all this stuff to make them, well, badass superheroes as it is. And I loved it. I loved the whole thing. And it wasn't just me that loved it. My wife loved it. And all four of my children, from the 17-year-old and the 14-year-old, who are usually... they can be a little cynical about things at times because they're teenagers and this is a kids movie. They were completely absorbed by it. And the 6-year-old sitting next to me could not stop talking about this film. He laughed throughout the whole thing. He was on the edge of his seat when the action scenes came up, and then afterwards could not stop talking about how awesome this film was and all the little things he noticed in it and all the cool stuff about it. It's a good movie. Go see it. Sadly, I've run out of anything that is meticulously plotted. So you know what that means. That's right. Italian's over here as I record. Why are you awake at 12:45 in the morning? What's wrong with you? Yeah, whatever. I'm a bad father. He's over there saying it for me. It's the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then you send your question or topic to me by email, or don't really send it by email. We all know better. Send it to me in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list, because Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. Our first number is a 3, right at the top of the list. Here we go. Number 3 is from Talvin. Talvin says, "So, the answer to the ultimate question is 42. What is your ultimate question?" God, I thought I was reading that wrong. And now I'm stalling for time. Usually my answer to this, because this is not the first time I've run across this, is what is the ultimate question, or what is your ultimate question? How many roads must a man walk down? And, you know, I could sit here and think for a few minutes, but I don't think I'm anything better than that. Well, hold on. Wait. Paul and Kyle admonished me and said, dude, when you're stumped, go to Google. So, what is the ultimate question? Let's find out. I'm going to leave a long pause here so I know where to edit all this junk out. Hold on a second. Oh, darn it. Now, you know what? The first, like, three or four results here are simply various Wikipedia, Wikia, more Wikipedia, TV tropes. See, it's all reference sites explaining to me what the whole joke is about the ultimate question and the fact that it has the answer 42. I get that. So, therefore, yeah. Now, too much digging here. I'm sorry. Even Google is not a help. We're going to go with how many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man. And clearly, 42. Oh, thank you for rescuing me from that R2. I was floundering. Okay, the next one is 48. This one is from Zimnipot. Zimny says, what does... why can I not read today? What is wrong with me? He says, why is dyslexia hard... One more time. Number 48. It's from Zimnipot. Blah, blah, blah. Why does dyslexia have to be so hard to spell? How was that so tough? Well, I'll tell you why, Zimny. Because it actually comes from, I believe, Latin roots. Maybe Greek, but it's probably Latin. Dis meaning, I don't know, faulty or not, anti, problematic, something. But dis is a negative prefix combined with lexia, which is the same as our root lexicon, but lexia being words, written words specifically. And so therefore, you have a problem with written words, dyslexia. There you go. That explains it. Number 39, Dire Cat. Hey, Dire Cat. He says, or she, I haven't ever met or asked, so I don't know. Let's assume he. Dire Cat says, if you could describe yourself in what word... Oh, my God! I'm not even going to edit these out anymore. I'm just going to keep stumbling through this whole damn podcast. If you could describe yourself in one word, what would it be? Let me see if my friend Ogre has anything to say about that. Number 77. Ooh, from Brasky. One of my favorite people. He says... Assume you have to search, and I say he because I've met him, and I know that he's a male. Well, okay, no, wait. I have proof in this case. Yeah, no, he's definitely a dude. All right, anyway, Bratsky says, assume you have to surgically attach the palm of Jeff Hawes's left hand to a part of your own body, and the two of you will have to remain that way forever. Where would you have him attached? Oh, good Lord, man. What? Probably, like, the back of my right shoulder. No, left shoulder. Clearly the left shoulder, because I use my right arm way more. Although, if I have Jeff there, he could do some of that for me, huh? I'll put his hand on the back of my... back of my left shoulder. That way I don't have to look at him all the time if I don't want to. I can pretend he's not there if I've got other things that I need to do. Not that I have a problem with hanging out with you, Jeff. I don't. I would love having you around. But, you know, any person 24/7 is going to be a little bit tedious. And being conjoined with you would probably get old for both of us after a while. But, I've got the palm of his hand on, and it's going to have to be your right hand, Jeff. I'm sorry. That sucks for you, doesn't it? But the palm of Jeff's right hand is now permanently attached to the back of my left shoulder. And that keeps him mostly out of the way for most stuff that I do. And maybe not even quite the shoulder, but more on the shoulder blade there. He'll constantly have my back, which I appreciate, and also be mostly out of the way. That is a really horrible question, man. That is just terrible. Because I know where you were going with this, and shame on you. 33. Hey, it's Brasky again. I can't believe you stuck around. Brasky says, I say captain, you say... .. Well, I say what? And then you say captain, and then I say what? And then you say captain, and then I say what? And then you say captain, and I say what you want. 74. Hey, Serious Paul is here. Serious Paul asks, in a battle between Cthulhu and the SDF-1, who wins? Well, hold up while I go look up SDF-1. Okay, all right. SDF-1 is a giant transforming spaceship from the series Macross, and it's an anime series, and the SDF-1 is roughly a kilometer and a half long in spaceship form, or maybe that's his height in robot form. I don't know. Either way, it is a massive spaceship and a massive robot when it transforms. And it has a crew of, again, the numbers are tough to figure out. It looks like it has a crew of 20,000 people, but a grand total complement of 70,000 because there's lots of civilians on board as well. Wow. Well, okay, SDF-1 is big, but I don't even see how it's a match for Cthulhu, honestly. Because one, it's really, it's run entirely by people. It does not appear from this description, at least what I read. I devoted a few minutes to it, but I don't want to spend forever on this because I have a podcast to do, people. And it appears that without the people, SDF-1 does not operate independently. And Cthulhu will own you. I don't care if you're inside a massive robot spaceship. That doesn't bother me at all. All right? Cthulhu will eat your brain. It will take your sanity, and it'll have this one in no time. And even if you think you've got some sort of shielding for your soul, which you don't, but even if you did, Cthulhu would take this on in a physical match and still come out on top because Cthulhu is as big as it needs to be for you to suffer. That's all it takes. Number 83. All right, Stan, why? Why you gotta go there? Stan says, how did you quit smoking? All right, the first time I quit smoking, for real, I mean, I quit smoking. When I did smoke, I started in college. I started my freshman year in college. And then I smoked for 15 years, 17 years, something like, no, that's not right, 7 years. Yeah, I got my math wrong there. Because it was from 88 to 97, so 9 years I smoked. And I wound up quitting lots of times in between there because I regretted it almost within the first year after I started, but I couldn't get off it. And then in 1997, my oldest son, Gygax, was just about to turn 2. And I was sitting on my front porch with my sister-in-law, and she had run out the night before because it was New Year's. It was New Year's Day, in fact. So she had run out the night before while everyone was having their New Year's parties. And so she came over, and I happened to have 2 left in my pack. And so I gave one to her, and I smoked one for myself. And I took it as kind of an omen that, hey, they're gone now. You know what? It's New Year's Day. My son is just about to turn 2. I don't want him to grow up with this as a constant in his life. I don't want to be that dude. And so I decided that that moment I was done. And that was it. That's how I quit smoking. I just stopped doing it. I don't know how I did that. I am floored by that level of willpower. And I wound up staying off cigarettes for a long, long, long time. And then a handful of years ago, I took it up again over the summer, and there was some stuff going on, and it was a cheap excuse. It was a, you know, we're hanging out with some people, and everyone else was smoking. I'm like, oh, you know what, I can have one. I've been off for so long, let me just try one. This is kind of cool. All right, whatever. And then, of course, I'm hooked again. And after a few months, quitting after that, actually took nicotine lozenges, which my brother had recommended, because he had also quit smoking before that even. And that's how he eventually got completely off of cigarettes, with nicotine lozenges. And I will tell you, I loved them. And then after I was done, for the longest time, because I got off the cigarettes, and I had no problem with that, and then I was on the lozenges for probably a couple months, maybe even longer than that. I don't remember. I remember when I said, okay, this is going to be my last pack of these nicotine lozenges, and then I'm done. And afterwards, I had these nicotine cravings, not nearly as bad as quitting smoking, but I still had these cravings that I didn't want a cigarette. I wanted a lozenge. God, I was hooked on those damn things. And I would go through, and I'm like, because they come in these little cool plastic cylinders, and I would go through, and there's like in my drawer where I usually keep those things, there's a couple of empty cylinders up there, and I keep pulling them out, going, oh, no, nothing in that one. Darn it! And so even giving those up was a little tough, but it's easier to quit the lozenges than it is to quit cigarettes. So that's how I did it. I don't know how anyone else does it, but yeah, cold turkey once and lozenges the next time. And that's what it took for me. Number 21. It is Brasky again. Wow, Paul, you have got to start getting in here. You are falling behind, my friend. Brasky is another one of these, which I don't care because I love these. Brasky says, so I've had my eye on Jimmy. You probably know him. Long Jimmy Lee. I've had my eye on Jimmy, and look, a fine man. That's him. So I've had my eye on Jimmy. What should I do? Wow. Brasky, that is very serious. And honestly, my best advice at this point is really better let him be. Because seriously, when you do go, I mean, ultimately when it happens and you do go, you're going to go with me. Number 32, a Mr. Serious Paul again. Hey, you took up my challenge, Paul. Thank you. Paul asks, okay, who would star in an updated Highlander? Ooh, that's an awesome question. And I don't know right off the top of my head. Italian, who should star in an updated Highlander movie? If we were going to remake Highlander right this moment, who would you put in it? Who would be the Highlander? Because there can be only one.
Guy who played Thor.
Ooh, all right, he's going with Hemsworth. He's going with Thor. And I cannot argue with that. That, wow, I am so glad you're here. Holy crap.
Love
yes.
You.
Yeah, dude, Chris Hemsworth would kill it as the Highlander. Kill it! He was made for that part. The man is, I was about to say, he is a god. Have you seen him? But yeah, he is. He's Thor. And yeah, no, that would be perfect. Awesome, awesome. All right, R2 rolls us up a 40 from Rave Master. Rave Master says, you said you were a cat person, so be honest. Have you ever tested the theory that cats always land on their feet? Oh, Rave, no. No, I never have. I have implemented many a cat torture, but I've never gone throwing them around just to see if they land on their feet. In my experience, in general, yeah, if you pick up a cat and you toss him across the room, he's going to land very nimbly on his feet and just walk away from you. But also, I've never thrown a cat in such a way as to test that. I mean, I will pick a cat up and heft it, you know, 5-6 feet across the room, but, you know, I'm throwing it in the upright position. His feet are already downward facing when I launch him so that I know he will land safely. I don't want to hurt the cat. I have played with putting scotch tape around a cat's paws. I did this in college when we had, oh, poor Calvin. She was such a sweet cat. She lived forever. Tried putting scotch tape around her feet because it drives them crazy, and so they walk around with this constant shh. Every time they take a step, they lift the foot up, they shake it, now the tape doesn't come off, they put it up. They lift up the next foot, they shake it, now that one's not coming off either, they put it back down. Funny to watch them do it. Horribly, horribly uncomfortable for them. I'm sure it drives them batty, and they really, really resent you for it, although she never resented me. She was a very loving cat. So clearly, I take it from that obviously it must have been okay. Better than that is, again, scotch tape. That's all you need to torture a cat is scotch tape. Take a little scotch tape and tape it to the center of the cat's forehead so that the piece of tape now hangs out just barely in front of their eyes in their field of vision. Okay? And the cat's immediate reaction to that is going to be, you set them down, they've got the tape right there on their forehead hanging out where they can just barely see it. They start backing up like crazy. They think something is right above them and they can't see what it is. They're afraid they're going to get attacked, so they start backing up, and the cat will shrink down and back up, and it will just back itself into a corner and wait there with its head shaking around like crazy, trying to figure out what the tape is, and eventually the tape just kind of flings off because it wasn't, it's scotch tape. It's not meant for sticking a cat fur, although it does it pretty well for a while. There's lots of other ways to do that. Cheese dip cans, the little Frito-Lay cheese dip cans. If you ever buy Frito-Lay cheese dip, awesome stuff. The jalapeno and cheddar flavor is my favorite. But those cheese dip cans, I would get them when I was in college. And back then, they actually came in some plastic cup sizes that were a little bit smaller, narrower, but deeper. And so after you finished the cheese dip, I would set the can down on the floor because, well, Calvin wanted to lick the extra cheese out of there. And so I would let her do that. Cats love cheese. And invariably, every time, she'd get around the edges, she'd start working her way down, and then she'd get to the very bottom of this cheese can, and she would start licking the bottom of it. And then when she'd get done, she'd lift up, sucker stuck to her face. I loved that. And she actually, after the first few times, she got really good at getting that back off of there. She knew how to shake her head and scrape it off on the door jamb. But it's really funny to watch her walk around with a cheese can on her face. But enough about Calvin. R2, go! Number 89. This one is from my good friend Zimney Pot again. Zimney Pot says, why do toasters always have a setting that burns the toast to a horrible crisp, which no decent human being would ever eat? That is an excellent question, and when I was a child, I wondered that myself. In fact, up until I got married and got a toaster for my wedding, all right, which came from a friend of mine, and that toaster lasted forever. Love that toaster. Then eventually the toaster died, and we had to get a new one. And so, you know, by now we've got kids, and so we go out and get a four-slot toaster with big wide slots in it. And this one, not only can you turn it up all the way to dark so that it will burn any normal piece of bread to a crisp, but there's actually a button that you can press, and when you press the button, it actually adds an extra minute to whatever time you just set on it, and that's the extra dark setting, the extra cook, all right? Why would it do that? I already have a setting that will burn my bread black. Why do I need a button that turns it up even more? Ah, and what I found out is, yeah, it's because of bagels. It's because of bagels and frozen toaster strudel and frozen waffles, Eggos. Do you have Eggos in Sweden? I don't know, Zim. But anyway, frozen waffles, stuff like this. So it's not the extra cook button, it's actually the frozen button. So if you put something that came out of the freezer, you stick it in your toaster, you hit that extra cook button, so it gives you a thaw time and then cooks it to your desired darkness. And so, yeah, bread, I only have that knob set, you know, it goes from zero to burnt to a crisp. Well, I set it about a quarter of the way up. I set it about 25%, and that gives me perfect toast. I like my toast where it starts to get a little crispy, and then just as it starts to turn from white to brown or from brown to cooked brown, I usually use wheat bread, just as it just starts to turn colors, boom, it pops up. That's perfect toast for me, and that's where I always keep that knob set. But then I don't have to move the knob. When I have like a bagel or if I have something frozen, I pop it in the toaster, and rather than having to adjust that knob and turn it way the hell up and then forget about it and burn my toast next time, no, I just hit the little button. I hit the little button to show, oh, this one's a thick thing. All right, cool. It gives me the extra cook time, cooks it perfectly, and then when it's done, I set it right back, and now it's ready for bread again. I love this function. So that's why they set it that dark, is that there are certain things that you need that actually have to cook longer than bread. The toaster can be used for more than just bread. And I love the way mine works. Whoa! R2 tells me this is the last one, number 65. 65 comes from a Serious Paul. Ooh, Serious Paul and Brasky are tied 3-3 this game. Woof. And unfortunately, since we're only competing at the college level, we are not going to go to a tiebreaker. Sorry, guys. You're going to have to leave it at that. Serious Paul asks, why won't my wife obey me? Well, that's because she's stronger than you. No, not physically. I know. In your line of work, you are a big, tough hunk of meat. You're like a linebacker. I get that, Paul. But mentally, spiritually, she's a stronger person than you. And you, deep down, You're just a cuddly teddy bear. Everybody knows it. That's why we love you, Paul. You just have to deal with that. It's part of your charm.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music for this week is Weezer's In the Garage and She Blinded Me with Science as performed by William Shatner. These songs are all available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. Enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes. Write me a nice review, because really only one person has done that yet. Go join them. Give me some extra stuff. Make me look good. Or you can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Stop at the Facebook page. Click like if you haven't already. Just add to my fame. It's just 9 seconds out of your day. Come on. You could do that for me. And then don't forget to check out all the free games I have available on my free games page, link from my homepage. Awesome stuff. And if you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com, but just, oh, what's the point of that? I promise, if you do, I will actually respond to you, but really, to be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is to sign up for the forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up, you send me a message, we will hang out together, we will have fun! Number 88. Hey, Zimny Pot's getting in there. What, does this make three for Zimny Pot? Did he win? Four? Zimny? Oh my god, it's a three-way tie. Zimny says, when you looked in the mirror first thing this morning, what was the first thing you thought? The first thing I thought when I looked in the mirror this morning is, wow, I am startlingly good-looking. But I think that really, even when I'm not looking in the mirror, today in particular, the one that was different from any other day, as I looked in the mirror, I thought, aw, I kind of miss my beard. Yeah, see, because today is December 1st. And I started November beard just a tad early, because you shave on the 31st of October on Halloween, and then you don't shave for the entire month of November. And I wound up, actually, my last shave was October 30th, so I got an extra day in at the beginning. And then last night, just before I went to bed last night, I went ahead and shaved it off. I know it was still the 30th technically, so it was still November, but I shaved it off, and it was just getting to where it was kind of bugging me. I love my beard. I really do. But, yeah, it was time to get it done. My wife doesn't like kissing me when I've got the beard because it's pokey. I get that. And so, again, it was nice to not have to shave for a while, but it was time to take it off. So I get up this morning. First thing I do is go look in the mirror, and I'm like, oh, dude, that's right, the beard's gone. I forgot. Wow. And yet, I'm still startlingly good-looking. I'm awesome that way.